welcome to another episode of Old School Guns. This is episode number 61. So, yeah, we got a lot of interesting things to talk about. And the first one is, in case you don't know, we have basically three parts to the show, which is some political commentary vis-a-vis guns and a few related items. Also, some gun media critiques of things that are said and done in the gun media, and also just some general observations. And then my favorite part, which is questions and answers. So those are the three parts of the podcast. So let's get after some of the political news. Okay, as everybody saw and probably a lot of people predicted, Bloomberg implodes on the debate stage. Now, he's got another chance coming up, and he'll probably do a little bit better. But, you know, the bottom line is, Bloomberg, you know, I mean, this is some evil Daddy Warbucks kind of guy who can't connect with people. You know, he's kind of cold, condescending. He doesn't care about anybody. He cares about his agenda. And that's really it. So nobody is really going to follow this guy. Yeah, he's spending some money and, you know, taking out the dorky ads. But when people actually get a look at him, it's not going to be a very pretty picture. And, you know, even the other Democrats, the only good thing about the swamp is at least the Democratic swamp is kind of energized against him. They don't like him because he's, you know, there's no way a billionaire is going to wage the kind of class warfare that the Democrats want to wage. You know, there's no way that he's going to talk about reparations and all the other, you know, social injustices that Democrats see where that justifies their socialist behavior. And so they're never going to choose Bloomberg. But, you know, I'm glad that Bloomberg is running because he's wasting money that he would normally try to spend on gun control. So, yeah, go ahead and run, Mike. Run, Mike, run. and go spend that cash. So, yeah, and then once he gets his ass thoroughly beaten and trashed, he probably won't be such a big political activist anymore. So I would assume that his gun control efforts would probably kind of go away also, because he just isn't going to be a political player. This guy is, you know, he is what he is. He is what he is on the surface. And I think even the Democratic voters see that. He's not nearly radical enough. Although I would say all of them, every last one of them is basically a socialist and not that far removed from Bernie Sanders. I mean, they all want to take your guns, all of them, every last one of them. Even creaky old senilic Joe Biden, who's going around looking for corn pop or whatever. You know, they all want to take your guns and they all want to redistribute your wealth in some manner. You know, there might be nuanced differences, but that's basically what this whole field is coming out for. And I think they could be definitely headed for a historic landslide defeat because, you know, most people believe, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or whatever other issues you believe in or don't believe in, I think a lot of people believe that you should be able to earn most of what you keep and not just turn it over to people who don't earn anything and they don't deserve the same standard of living and other things as you do. You know, we'll see. We'll see how the voting turns out. But I just got this funny feeling that they're going down the wrong road. Okay, that brings us to Joe DOA Biden. I mean, this guy, even if he pulls off some sort of a miracle in South Carolina or whatever, you know, this guy's campaign, like we said earlier, is just dead. He can't seem to articulate anything. He just sort of, you know, wanders around, and his stories are getting weirder and weirder. Now he's claiming he was arrested in South Africa trying to see Nelson Mandela in jail. And the people who were on the trip with him say that, you know, there's no record of him ever having been arrested as a congressman or a senator. And, you know, this is all crazy. Joe Biden is crazy. And he's senilic and he's making up things. And it's only going to get worse from here. Even if he gets a little bit of a bump in South Carolina, you know, it's just going to get worse from here. He's saying things that are not true, and I'm not sure that he knows the difference between truth and fantasy. And I think he's definitely, if he isn't senile, he's at the doorstep, because he is exhibiting the kind of behavior that you see that's just very, you know, it's very disconcerting if you've ever seen anybody go through that. And I think he's definitely on the deal there. But yeah, Joe's done. Joe's cooked. And he'll be eating his tapioca pudding and his creamed corn here pretty soon. And say, yeah, I ran in 2020. And that's going to be all he knows. And he won't recognize any, he won't even recognize his new grandchild, Burisma Biden, the one who was born to the woman in Arkansas or whatever that they just found out about. He won't even know who he recognized his new grandson, Burisma. All right. So, you know, on good news, Virginia sees the light. Enough pressure was brought to bear through the march, through, I'm sure, NRA lobbying efforts, probably through some voters who said, hey, I may have voted for you, but I didn't vote for this, all this gun control stuff you're doing. They finally got a couple of the state senators to crack, the Democratic ones, and their most onerous gun control bills did not pass. And you saw it just made the left furious. As a matter of fact, that those legislators who caved and actually did the right thing, they're going to get punished by their party. There's no two ways about that. But, you know, they took a calculated risk. And the risk is that, hey, the Democrats will be out of power in Virginia come this next election. And sanity will be restored. But they'll be kind of, the Republicans won't run as hard against them because those guys actually cracked and did the right thing. So we'll see how this goes out. Okay, to talk about some gun culture stuff. I haven't done a podcast for about 2 weeks. And in this time, I've been kind of looking at some of the bunk, the loads of bunk that the gun media has been fostering on you, the gun-buying public. And I just wanted to go over a few of the things which really kind of struck me and which I really found very interesting. The first one is that the 5.7 is the new hot item, that somehow this is the coolest thing, and all the guys who want to be cool kids are going to go get these 5.7s, whether they're Ruger, and they're even saying the Ruger's better than the original FN. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but they're saying this is good. Now, I looked at this, and I tried to figure it out. I even mentioned it in an earlier podcast. What possible use is there in reviving this? The ammo's expensive, requires kind of a longer, bigger grip on the gun. It's kind of a .22 caliber. What's the real attraction here? Why is it so popular? Or I should say, why are they making it so popular? Why are they trying to generate all this interest? And you know, as I looked at it and looked at it again, I realized, of course, like some of the newer guns have, it's got a removable plate on the top of the slide where you can put on any number of these optics, you know, these red dot pistol-sized tiny optics, little kind of, I think reflex sight is probably the wrong term, but anyway, whatever those little things are. So I looked at that and I said, you know what, with 20 round capacity, just in the standard frame, this is probably going to turn into a gamer gun. This will be the new gamer hotness. Because a long time ago, the gamers gave up. It's still around, but they gave up on major and minor, you know, and that was a device designed so that you couldn't come in with smaller caliber handguns and basically clean everything and win everything, because you had a lower recoil impulse and a higher capacity. So they penalized competitors who used like 9mm. And the workaround for that was, well, 40 would make major. And if you hot loaded a 38 Super, a very bad idea, but people did it. If you hot loaded a 38 Super, you could get it just over the line. And therefore, you know, it basically was mitigated that way. And then, you know, lately they've just gone completely, completely away from major. They still have it, and they still do it, and they still penalize you, but it's just not enough to overcome the advantages of having a lighter recoiling and higher capacity gun, even with mandatory magazine changes and all the rest. It just, you know, gamers will be gamers, and the minute you make a rule, everybody's trying to figure out the most efficient way to mitigate it and get around it. And, you know, what can I do that's within the keeping of the rule that still gives me an advantage? So if you look at the USPSA rule book, there's a reason that that thing's about 3 inches thick, and it's rule after rule after rule. And when I went through their range officer training, it was all about learning and applying the rules. That's all it's really about. I mean, yeah, they focused on range commands, but it's really about all the rules. Hey, you know, you got to measure this. Is this holster too far away from the belt? Is, you know, all this freaking nonsense that's just caused by gamers trying to gain that extra fraction of a second. And clearly, they're going to go to these. As soon as somebody wins a match with a 5.7 gun, there's going to be basically a stampede towards those things. So this is the new hot item. It's being hyped. And if they can get the ammo cost down, they'll never get it down to where, you know, low-end 9mm is. But if they can get that cost down, that's going to be the new hotness. And expect to see a flood of these things coming out, because the monkey see, monkey do mentality in the gun industry will, somebody else will have one out, then somebody else. And, you know, you look at the Ruger. It's actually perfect for all this. It's really a single action with a concealed hammer that's inside the slide. You know, it's really not set up for defensive carrier use. It's designed, in my mind, strictly for gaming, strictly for that. So that's what you're going to see. But the load of bunk is, this is the next cool round. And if you're not into this, you're cool, because there's going to be coronavirus, Iranian sleeper cells wearing all kinds of advanced body armor, wandering around the country wanting to do you harm, and this is the only thing that's going to combat them. You know, I mean, or there'll be drug cartels, you know, who are in body armor suits, and this is the only way you're going to stop them when they come marching down Main Street to hoist their cartel's flag over your city hall. You know, I mean, it just you could just see it coming, that this is going to be the new cool thing. And there will be, I guarantee, there will be some law enforcement agency somewhere, and I'm guessing it'll be federal, they will adopt and buy some of these for special use. They'll say, well, you know, if we, you know, they'll want to have something that can penetrate body armor in a handgun, and that's what they will buy, and they'll have them. They may not use them, may not even issue them, may just sort of have them for a while. But somebody will adopt it. Then the floodgates will yet again open. So be prepared. I think you're going to hear a lot more from the 5.7. Okay, the other load of bunk, and this has been coming out since they introduced the new Colt King Cobra and the new Python. Here's the refrain you're hearing. Older revolvers really aren't that good. You know, the newer revolvers are much better. You know, we kind of, the older revolvers, everybody's kind of looking at them almost like cap and ball revolvers, you know. Just, yeah, they were cool in their time, but, you know, now we have something so much better. Okay, it's a complete load of bunk. It's a complete load of bunk, and here's the deal on it. Older revolvers involved more hand finishing, and they did not have the benefits of NIM parts, which are, you know, powdered steel parts that they kind of can put in and shape, and they basically mold them. they put them in and mold them, and those are somehow better than the ones that they made the old-fashioned way, you know, with mills and lathes and out of solid steel. Okay, it's complete horse manure. Complete horse manure. NIM parts, they're satisfactory enough. But, you know, the fact of the matter is those old revolvers exhibited a quality of manufacture that most people appreciate, and that, you know, we pay a lot of money for today. These guys who are buying the, and we'll get to it later, the custom 1911s that cost $4,000 or $5,000, they're not paying for NIM parts, the better NIM parts, to be slapped in a frame and pushed out a production line and then, you know, handed to you at a store after you fork over money. That's not what Wilson Combat, Ed Brown, Cabot, all these high-end manufacturers, that's not what they do. They actually have a craftsman assemble the revolver, or I'm sorry, the auto pistol, the same way that Colt used to assemble revolvers. I told you about the, I received for Christmas, actually, a very nice gift. It was a history of Colt revolvers, and it was published in 1940. And they devote, and it's interesting, it's the standard stuff, you know, okay, the Walker, and before that, the Patterson, and, you know, 51 Navy, and going up through the different models. But when they get into what the modern Colts, these pre-1940 Colts, you know, official police, police positive, and those types of revolvers, there is a section on the quality control and inspection process they had. And frankly, that's what's missing today, because that costs money. You've got to have somebody who's highly trained, knows what he's doing, and doing that. Quality control should not be left to the end consumer, but that's what we're seeing these days in a lot of products. If it's crappy, send it back to us. And, you know, that's fine for something you buy out of Walmart or Amazon, you know, some Chinese-made piece of junk that you just need because you need it for a one-time use, or it's the cheapest one and it's going to be fine. That's fine. You know, it comes goofed up, you send it back. But when you're paying $1,500 or $1,700 like you are for a new Python, you're paying $1,000, you expect that somebody with some training has looked at the finished product and said, hey, this is good to go. This is good to go. I've looked at it. Even if they only spend a few minutes, they don't have to spend a lot, because you would expect that they would know what to look for. But some of the things popping out, I mean, everybody's dogging this guy out, but there's the guy Webb on the, called Golden Webb on YouTube, bought a Python, and it's not a very nice gun. I mean, he bought it, and, you know, he pointed out there are finish problems with it, and then it didn't function properly, and he sent it back to Colt, and, you know, has been getting the usual runaround of, well, did you take the side plate off that? Well, no, he didn't. He didn't. He said he didn't. He took it out of the box, went out and fired it, and it started exhibiting these problems. You know, that's just unacceptable. That kind of quality control for a product that expensive is just unacceptable. And, you know, a lot of these new guns, they're fine. There's nothing wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with the Smith & Wesson that's got the lock and all the rest of it. But a lot of people prefer the workmanship in the older revolvers. And I will say that I know there are guys who've done this. They've taken the old one. They've taken like a Smith & Wesson triple lock, you know, supposedly the best double-action revolver ever made, because somehow it had a third place where the cylinder locked. And they'll shoot that against a modern revolver, and it's not superior. It's not that great. Of course, it's over 100 years old, and of course, it's got a lot, that 100 years of wear on it. But the fact of the matter is, yes, the new guns can be, if you get one that's been inspected and has been put together correctly, yes, they can be wonderfully accurate. And CNC machining does tighten up tolerances. But there's a lot of people who appreciate the workmanship and craftsmanship in the older guns. And you see it with the exterior finish. You don't see that beautiful Smith & Wesson bluing anymore. You don't see Colt Royal blue on something. They did not make the new Python out of stainless steel by accident. They did that because they never have to refinish that gun. All they ever, if it gets returned to them scratched, all they got to do is buff it and then send it back out. So that's why you will probably not see blue steel Colt guns coming out. I just imagine that they don't want to deal with the bluing process and the chemicals and all the environmental stuff connected with that. And they'll tell you that, well, stainless steel is better. And for some uses it is. But if you want that beautiful blue finish, you're going to have to go to Turnbull or somebody and have them refinish an existing gun because that's the only way you're going to get that redone. So that's some of the bunk there. Okay, some more bunk, which is related, is, and I kind of got on Facebook for shattering this on something. I should never comment on Facebook. I should never do it, but sometimes I just can't help myself. But 1911s are for boomers, geezers, and old farts. Okay, you know, I realize that that kind of stuff is just designed to get a reaction from people. But, you know, there are actually fools that believe that. There are actually idiots that believe that. And I think a lot of this started with something I've talked about before. You get the shills out there. And what they're saying is, you know, a 1911, it's really an enthusiast's gun. You know, it takes a lot of tweaking and blah, 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 blah. What they're saying is that it's obsolete. They're saying that it's not sufficient for the use that most people have for an auto pistol. That's what they're saying. Now, they're being a little coy, and they're just using enthusiast pistol. You know, and this is, Vickers has said it, Hackathorn has said it, and a bunch of these other guys have said it. And they're full of shit. They're completely full of shit. At the Battle of Iwo Jima, we did not land 100,000 men, of which 15,000 were pistol enthusiasts because they carried 1911s. It's just not the case. We did not fight World War II with an enthusiast weapon. We did not fight World War I, Korea, or the Vietnam War with an enthusiast pistol. You know, and, you know, the fact of the matter is, for the use that people have, and for the use that the military had, the 1911, entirely sufficient in practically every way. Entirely sufficient. And I shattered this on Facebook by saying, well, I know guys who use 1911s in the War on Terror, and those were special operations people who have a wide latitude in the kind of weapons they can carry. And some of them, the Marsat people, it was their own, they let out a contract and they got 45 automatic pistols, newly made, that had, you know, the rail on the dust cover and a bit more modern, but still a 1911, iron-sighted at heart. And I knew Army Special Forces guys who used rebuilt, in the World War II production, M1911s. That was used in Iraq. So to say that it's an age thing is ridiculous. There are a lot of young people who like 1911s, and there are a lot of older people that like the newer guns. I myself don't really care for the newer guns, but I'm not adverse to them. I'm not allergic to them. I mean, mine is based on my personal preference, which is I've shot a 45 Glock, and I don't like it. I shoot a 1911, and I do like it. It's just that simple. For target shooting purposes, I like to have a nice 1911 with a good trigger pull and nice adjustable sights. That's very difficult to get on a Glock. So I like the 1911 for that purpose. I like it just for carrying purpose with fixed sights. And that's just me. That's just me. And in fact, one of my favorite guns is a Star BM, which is, you know, a 9mm. It's like a little bit smaller than a Commander, and it's heavy. It's all steel, but it's a great little gun to shoot, and it's got minimal recoil, and it really does. It's really a nice gun. It's like a little miniature 1911. It does not have the grip safety, but in every other way, it really looks like a 1911, you know, I think it's a great little gun, and you know, you can still get those things for like under $2. They may have some cosmetic issues, but functionally they'll still work, and they're good little guns. I mean, is it a gun I would shoot 5 or 10,000 rounds with? Probably not. You know, I would probably, if I were going to a pistol course, would I use it? I would use it for part of it, but I might not use it for the whole thing. I mean, it's not a gun I plan to shoot thousands and thousands of rounds out of. It's a gun I plan to occasionally use, occasionally carry, and it's a very, very good gun. But that's what I like. People should focus on what they need and what they like. And if you're a guy who has, who does not like 1911s, and there are people who are that way, they had either a bad experience, older people who had a bad experience with them in the service, or people who bought one because they thought they heard from Jeff Cooper and everybody that it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. They got it, they didn't like it. And if they like a different kind of firearm, a different kind of pistol, then so be it. Focus on yourself rather than calling other people's names. You know, boomer, geezer, old fart, you know, that's just really, I mean, how childish is that? How childish is that? I know some very young people who are very traditional, and they like older guns. Those are the guns I like. And as much as the gun industry and elements of the gun community do not like it, the market for old guns remain, older firearms remain very, very popular. Old school guns, the name of this podcast, they remain very, very popular. And it goes back to the earlier question of quality. It goes back to the earlier thing of a historical connection. Or it's just that they're tried and true. You know, you buy some of these new things and, you know, they are what they are. You can't believe the hype when something comes out. I can tell you that I knew a guy who was, he was actually writing for an outdoor magazine, and he would get sent the free backpack, you know, the $200 backpack, and he didn't really like it, but the write-up had to be positive, so you kind of get into this faint, you got to read between the lines of this faint praise, and you see that a lot with guns, you see that a lot with pistols especially. And of course, I'll talk about one of the funniest things about all this is, if you look at modern auto pistols, you look at just all of them, very few, very few of them are anything other than Browning patents or variations of Browning patents. So, a Glock is more closely related to a 1911 than a lot of people would like to admit. And you look at the way the slides are and the lockups, the techniques of locking things up and all that are different, but there's the same principle. I mean, it's the Browning patents and the information derived from those patents that has just driven auto pistol design since the 1920s. I mean, you know, there's a reason we're not shooting Astra 400s anymore. There's a reason we're not shooting Lugers anymore. There's a reason we're not seeing a lot of guns built on the Mauser C96 system or the Bergmann or some of these other ones. They all basically culminated, and the one that survived and the one that basically proliferated were Browning patent derivative guns. I mean, everything from the Tokarevs to, you know, it just goes on and on and on. And so then you're really talking about caliber and some of the nuance differences. And I realize the little flap trigger, the safety trigger safeties, you know, that's something new. But, you know, they're really, and of course, materials change. You know, you can go to aluminum, and you can also go to polymer, but, you know, steel is still there. And you know, it's the nuances are not all that different. Even something that's very different, seemingly, the Beretta has some features on it that, you know, you can attribute. You can say, yeah, this is basically, they looked at a Browning patent, and that's kind of where everybody came from, and it's all branches of the same tree. So I don't see that as a particularly big deal, and I don't know why other people do, but yes, they do, and they make fools out of themselves for saying it. And what I don't like is the gun culture people coming out and saying, well, you know, you really need this polymer frame gun. No, I don't. I know what I need. And don't advise people who are still making up their minds or still collecting information and facts and data. Don't try to adversely influence them basically because you want to sell something for a new manufacturer. And these guys are all in the pockets of these manufacturers, man. If you have any kind of a platform and people listen to you, those guys come and they basically want to curry favor, and the manufacturers will unload the goodies and all the other stuff on them. So you'll see what it is, and understand that some of these guys who are actually representing the industry to you, they're not representing you to the industry. Okay, 9mm improved loads make the 40 Smith & Wesson and the 45 ACP obsolete. You know, we've been hearing this for a couple years now. It started when law enforcement did the swing away from the 40 cal. And that happened for a whole bunch of reasons. The biggest reasons that happened was not that there are all these improved loads out there. The biggest reason that happened was because they have officers who are not gun people or who have smaller stature, because they have more female officers, or they have more people from different minority groups who may be smaller in stature, or they have people who just have no familiarity with firearms at all. And for those reasons, it was decided, and it was a good reason, that the 9mm was easier to shoot, it was effective, and, you know, as a whole, the marksmanship standard of their department across the board could be raised by using an easier-to-shoot service pistol. Okay? That was the real reason they did that. It had nothing really to do with effectiveness. It had really nothing to do... capacity probably figured in there a little bit, too. Although, I would say that police departments get in trouble when somebody's shot 35 times taking the little square brown wallet out of their back pocket, and three officers just unload on the guy, and pretty soon he's been shot 30 times. I would say that's probably a liability. But, you know, in the real world where, you know, anything can happen, it's nice to have a 15 to 17 or 18 round pistol as opposed to a 12 or 14 round pistol, I suppose, if you're a policeman doing police work. So those are reasons that happened. Not that somehow they want you to believe that somehow a wand was waved over the 9mm and now it's coming back bigger and better than ever. And it's not. I would also tell you that police might be a different matter, but for the average guy who carries, the average CCW carry, when they talk about all these improved loads, they never tell you what those loads are for the most part. And this goes with the in-range TV guys. You know, they're big saying, well, the 45 ACP is obsolete. Well, they don't know anything. They don't. They're gamers. They don't know. And in their game, it is obsolete because they've moved beyond that. And pretty soon, they'll be telling you how obsolete the 9mm is because the 5.7 is going to be the new hotness. So the 45 ACP is not obsolete. The 40 is not obsolete. They're both very good guns. And I think if you want to make a good buy on the market today, you buy a 40 Smith & Wesson Police Trade-In Compact, and you have a very good carry gun there, a very good carry gun. But I'll also say that if you go and find these guys who carry a 9mm routinely, if you look at their ammunition, I would say that there's a very high percentage who are not carrying these new and improved loads, that they're carrying the same old stuff that they've always carried. I guarantee that most of them are carrying at least part of the time, if not most of the time, the same ammunition they practice with, which is the cheapo FMJ 124, 115 grain, because they know it's reliable in their guns. They know they've practiced with it. And, you know, these high-end loads, you know, those things cost. They cost. And they're over a buck a round in some cases. It's really good stuff. And I will tell you, Fort Scott produces excellent stuff. And I think this newer company, Steinel, is producing excellent stuff. And I would say that, you know, you can't go wrong with either of those. You cannot go wrong. But I don't think that anybody's buying cases of this stuff and shooting it. They buy it, maybe function fire it, load it in their magazines, carry it around. And then they practice with the cheap stuff. Well, at a certain point, human nature being what it is, the cheap stuff's going to get carried as good enough. You know, we kind of laugh at criminals because they don't look at ammo. As long as it fits in the gun and fires, they don't care. And when a lot of guns are confiscated from criminals, they'll find all kinds of mixed head stamp and everything else where they've just gotten a handful of ammunition from here, there, or anywhere. So, you know, but a lot of the carriers are doing the same thing. This kind of goes back to way back in the day where a lot of guys were carrying 357s, and mine's a 357. Well, but they were loaded with 38s. They were loaded with the 158 grain 38, but you were carrying a 357. When in fact they were carrying a big chunky 38, you know, because you know terminally the terminal ballistics and the exterior ballistics of the cartridge were the same, no matter if you fired it from a 38 special gun or a 357 gun. But they'll tell you they're carrying a 357 when in fact it's loaded with 38s. And this is kind of the same thing that we're seeing with 9mm. Just saying. So when they tell you that, you know, somebody talks about new and improved loads, you might want to ask them, well, what new and improved load do you carry? Or what's the list of new and improved loads? And watch the blank look come over their face. Because, you know, it is just another kind of rationalization and another kind of, you know, gun shop commando talk excuse. And it doesn't really make any sense. The other reason that this is so funny is, you know, every manufacturer with capacity makes a 1911 45 auto. Makes a 45. They do. So if it was all that obsolete, it would have been gone ages ago. I mean, it would have just been gone ages ago. The funny part is there's a new company called Webley and Scott India, which is the reincarnation of the Webley and Scott from Great Britain, which, you know, can't be in Great Britain anymore because they don't allow any kind of handguns. So it's been reincarnated in India, and they make a brick top Webley. Looks just like something out of the 19th century, man, or it's the 38, you know, kind of the one they adopted right after World War One, really. You know, they make that in a 2.5-inch barrel, you know, with a small grip. Very nice looking gun, very cool looking. They make that. They make a pump shotgun. I think they make an over and under shotgun. They make a 32 auto pistol, 32 ACP, but I've only seen that in renderings on their website. It's not like they have a picture of a real one. So that may be something that's in the works and not really real yet. And guess what else they make? A 1911 45 ACP. I mean, this is Webley and Scott India. So, you know, you can't just write off the 45 ACP, and you just can't write off the 1911, no matter what the pundits and experts will tell you. So, anyway, those are the four loads of bunk. The 5.7, the trash-talking older revolvers. 1911s are only good for boomers and geezers. And the 9mm improved rounds have made the 40 and 45 obsolete. Those are four loads of bunk that are being fed, offered out by these guys, and they're trying to feed you that. So now you kind of know at least a dissenting opinion. Okay, let's go into the best part of the program, for most fun for me anyway, which is questions and answers. And our first question is one of my favorites, and I've talked about this before. A little bit, long time ago, you know, probably 3 or 4 months ago, I talked about this. What are the best truck guns? The answer to that is I have no earthly idea. People talk about truck guns all the time. And, you know, that used to be like really popular when, you know, doomsday preppers and all that kind of nonsense was out there. People got to have a truck gun. And I never quite figured it out why. It used to be that, well, I'll just buy one of those cheap Moisen M44s and kind of keep it in my truck in case something really, you know, something really radical happens and I need to be armed and I'm out away from home and there's just me and my truck. So, you know, that'll be my truck gun, and it can just kind of stay and live in there. And because it's cheap, I don't really care if it gets scuffed up or whatever else. You know, so you'd hear that, or you would hear, I'm going to buy a high point pistol and keep that in my truck. Or the best one was, I keep a high point in my tackle box. And I'm like, oh, my. Well, anyway, I'll talk about high points a little later. But, yeah, so, you know, I didn't understand. It's just having a weapon to have a weapon. And my deal is there's no such thing as a truck gun. And the reason I say that is because a firearm you're going to carry has to have a purpose. Now, if you're trying to defend yourself against, you know, bad people, I don't know that the Moisin 44 or the High Point or what I would want to have in my hand. If you're in a situation where you expect that you're going to run into trouble, you want a very capable firearm and not just the cheapest one that can live in your truck. I guess the theory is, well, it's better than nothing. But I look at it, it should be a gun if it's the gun that's most likely to be in your hand when you're confronting danger or in trouble, then maybe it shouldn't be the lowest priced, most expendable thing you can find. Maybe it should be of reasonable quality. And I get it. You don't want your Wilson Combat or Ed Brown or your Cabot 45, you know, going back to the earlier thing. You know, you don't want the $4,000 1911 to be something that's riding around in your truck and is going to get confiscated by the police if you go ahead and use it in defense. So I fully get that. I also get the fact that not everybody can afford, and I'm certainly in this category, I cannot afford a $4,000 1911 under any circumstance. So, you know, I get that. So I get the low-cost kind of handy utility gun that you would keep in a truck, but nobody can really define the purpose. And every carrying a firearm has to have a purpose, and then you select the tool that best fits that purpose and the budget or the resources you can devote to it. It's just very simple. So I'm not a fan of truck guns. I don't believe in them. I certainly wouldn't. My view on the discussions I've had and have seen, okay, high point pistol, frankly, I don't have any confidence in high point pistols, so I wouldn't use them. There's better alternatives. So there you go. So no high points. High point carbines have a reasonable reputation. That might be a better choice, but, you know, frankly, I'm not real impressed with those either. They seem to be kind of Planet of the Apes clunky looking things to me. But, you know, if they work, they're fine. It's about you. It's not about what I want. It's about what you want. But one of the funniest things I heard, and this was on a podcast a few days ago, somebody goes, well, you know, if you could just have go get an old Winchester 30-30. And I'm sitting there going, well, since they stopped making those, they've become collector's items, and there are no old cheap Winchester 30-30s anymore. Any lever, and then they talked about lever guns in general, whether they are pistol caliber or, you know, rifle caliber like 30-30 and all that. You know, the last I saw, and this is looking at new and used prices, hey, the lever action guns, you're closer to $1,000 than you are $100. You're closer to $1,000 than you are $500. I'm talking center fire guns. You know, rim fires are a different deal. So, you know, I don't know about you, but that's a lot of money, and that's not just something you just leave in a truck and abuse. So I don't know the cheap firearm. I would say that if you need a defensive rifle and you need a defensive handgun, go ahead and carry something that you practice with, have confidence in, and everything else. Find a good way to carry it in your gun, but there's no real gun I would feel comfortable leaving in a truck or in a tackle box or anything else, especially loaded. You know, that's, you know, you have to be very careful. Cars and trucks get broken into all the time, so that's another consideration, is having a loaded gun in there. Somebody breaks in, steals it. how liable are you legally? And the answer is, I would say different states have probably got different answers for that. So be very careful with truck guns. All right, this next question is, this is really an easy question. What is your opinion of George Zimmerman? My first impression is that I don't know why anybody talks about George Zimmerman anymore, other than it was a landmark case. George Zimmerman is a very flawed individual. He's not like the guy who stopped the church shooting in Texas. You know, this stand-up, you know, really nice, moral guy. George Zimmerman is a dirtbag in many ways. However, his case, and not to go over any of the specifics, but his case was litigated in court, and the answer was he was acquitted. And, you know, that's the way that goes. You don't have to be a perfect person to basically be in the right in a self-defense situation. You know, it's the left always likes to say, well, this is a bad person, therefore he must be, what he did must have been bad. You know, it's the same thing as the old rape defense, where they take the victim and want to basically go over every element of their past to prove that they were somehow, that them being raped either didn't happen or really wasn't something unexpected. It's pretty heinous, pretty heinous. But Zimmerman is, I guess he's suing a couple of candidates now because they were talking smack about the Stand Your Ground case. Even though that all happened under the Obama administration, they always seem to leave that out. But anyway, no, he was basically a flawed person who legally asserted his right to self-defense and was acquitted. Now, was he smart? No, the guy's not smart at all. He should have avoided the situation because, you know what? He basically kind of confronted and was following around a guy who was a thug, and the thug grabbed him and started beating his head against a concrete sidewalk. And the only reason that Zimmerman survived and the other guy did not was that Zimmerman had a pistol, pulled it out, and put one shot in the guy's torso and killed him. You know, that was it. And, you know, it was a piece of luck. He could have gotten his head beaten flat, gotten his skull crushed on the sidewalk. So, you know, it is what it is. But yeah, he is suing some people who were mouthing off about that, some of the candidates. How that all works, I don't know. You know, I don't know that I would do that in his situation, but I don't know that I wouldn't do that. I mean, I imagine he's sick and tired of being vilified, so when somebody does it and they got deep pockets, he's going to go after some money. That's just the way human nature kind of works. Okay. So I don't have a good opinion of him. So there you go. Here's one that comes up occasionally. Is hand loading still viable? And does it make sense today? And for the gun enthusiast, you know, yes, it does. And the reason I hesitate on this is, you know, hand loading is just not a cheap way to get ammo. It's just not. It's a whole hobby in and of itself. And there's a whole bunch of things to learn. A lot of things to learn. And I started out with, you know, single stage press and, you know, cranking out little 38 specials and all that. Actually, I started out with a lead loader, which was a little thing that came in a little red box, and I used that for like 2 months before I got a real press and all that. So, you know, and it's a reasonable hobby to have, a very reasonable hobby. The thing about it is, the reason it's not the panacea that it's portrayed to be is that you still have to buy components. So, you know, you have to buy components, and components have a cost. It's like anything else. You have to write your labor off because there's no way that your labor cost would ever justify it. And then you have a substantial equipment investment. And depending on how heavy you go into it, it's going to be pretty hefty. I mean, I have a Dillon RL550, a very good machine. But I will also tell you that, you know, I saw a guy who had like four Dillons in his workshop. And I go, wow, why would you ever need more than one? Because you can change calibers. And he goes, change calibers and you'll see why. And the fact of the matter is the Dillon machine is just like all the rest of the progressive machines. It absolutely is springs, levers, all this kind of mechanical stuff. You know, it's an engineer's delight. If you're a mechanical engineer, you would love these things because they're ingenious and they're put together well. But you spend a lot of time setting up and adjusting these, and it's not a lot of fun sometimes to get this thing adjusted, because then the primers won't feed, and then, you know, to make this thing really efficient, you got to have the primer feed. The bullet feed I don't really have, but, you know, you got to have the primer feed to get all this stuff working. Once you get it set up and working, it's pretty good. It'll run about 1,000 rounds, and then you probably have to go back in and tweak the adjustments a little bit. You know, but you get it set up for one caliber, and you're rather hesitant to change it. So it's best to set it up and run some measure of thousands of rounds through it, reload them, and go. Hand loading is, for turning out all your practice ammo and all that, is still viable. But, you know, it's not as good. And some calibers, it doesn't even pay to do it. Does not pay to hand load 9mm. Just doesn't. I don't like lead bullets in 9mm because they tend to lead the bore, and that's a chore to clean out. So for 9mm, I find it's a loser. For 45, it's a winner because the velocities of a 45 ACP don't really lead the bores. So lead bullets are a good thing. And you can get them from a number of places. Or if you have lead, you can cast your own. That's yet another whole adventure to get into. So to produce, some loads, and especially if you have brass, you know, you've saved all your brass and all that, you know, you can make some economy there, but you do have to amortize out the cost of the equipment, and you have to figure out if the cost of the components is worth it. Now for obsolete calibers, it's the only way to go, and you don't need a Dillon machine for that. You can, with a single stage press, I do the famous 577 450 Martini Henry. I do 3840 and a few other oddball things. 351 Winchester. Stuff that you cannot buy or cannot buy economically. It's the only way to go. It's the only way to go, and you make your own and roll. But it is time consuming, and you can ruin cases. You can do all kinds of things. You gotta learn by experience how to adjust things and how to make sure everything chambers, and, you know, but for the most part, you can do that. For 45 Colt and 44 Magnums, it's also kind of the only way to go, because you buy a box of that stuff and you're paying, looks like, about $30 even for cowboy loads. So there's some loads that, and some calibers that you're actually, if you want to use them at all, you're actually forced into some hand loading. So yes, it still does make sense today, but it is not simple. It is not a magic wand that just, you know, you don't set up your Dillon and there are no elves that show up and produce ammo for you. It's a lot of hard work, and it requires some effort. Okay, next question. InRange TV said that the lever action, like the Winchester 1873, was the first assault rifle. Is that true? Well, no, it's not. But I think the point they were trying to make is that in concept, it was the first assault rifle, insofar as it was, for the time, high capacity, and fired something less than a full power rifle cartridge, and was capable, at least in some fashion, of suppressive fire. Okay. All of that is thinking after the fact. The Winchester, the precepts that would have led us to the assault rifle weren't around in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. And in fact, It kind of looks that way when you think about it, but the way they frame it, it kind of looks that way, but it's not. The reason that the first Winchesters, and even going back to the Henry rifle of 1860, and then the Winchester 66 and 73, the reason that those were chambered in pistol cartridges was because the action could not tolerate a more powerful cartridge. And they couldn't do that because of the weakness of the toggle link system and also just the size. Winchester, and in fact, if they had been trying to make something assault rifle-like, they would have just stayed with those and tried to improve that, as opposed to what the market wanted was a lever-action rifle in a large caliber. And they tried with the 1876. It was modestly successful. And they were completely successful with the Winchester 1886. The 92 kind of kept the pistol cartridge line going. But then after that, the Model 94, Model 95 were rifle cartridge lever action. So they were never designed to be an assault rifle, an intermediate kind of cartridge, high firepower weapon. And the theory that the US Army was too stupid to see the potential of the lever action didn't really work out either. At the time, the competing militaries of the world were all shooting more powerful cartridges and what we would call rifle cartridges. So you could argue that maybe the British would have been better off at Ishluwanda if they had lever actions, or Custer would have been better off at Little Bighorn. But the fact of the matter is, lever actions were never really seriously used for military action. The Turks used some, and of course the Russians did in World War I. But they have durability and reliability problems when they're used like a military gun. They're harder to clean. There's a whole bunch of reasons why they were not really great military arms. Just a whole lot of reasons. And one of the reasons are they, unless you get a military musket model, they don't mount bayonets, which were essential in the 19th century. They're just an essential weapon, the way it goes. So, it was never really designed to be an assault rifle. It was never designed with the precepts of the assault rifle having been laid down. And it was designed to be kind of a handy, convenient carbine that you could get follow-up shots with without having to muzzle load. All the early guns, whether it's Sharps, whether it's Spencer, or the litany of the other ones, they weren't designed to be high firepower weapons. They were designed to be weapons that could fire faster than muzzle loading guns of the time. And the Winchester was the same way. The Henry and the Winchester were the same way. Now, it just happens to be really kind of a happy coincidence that years later, 80 years later, intermediate cartridges kind of became a thing. And therefore, you could look back and say, well, this rifle kind of fit these parameters too in some fashion. But I would also say that, there's always been kind of lower powered rifles. There certainly were the Winchester 1905, 1907, 1910 series that came out right after, the turn of the 20th century. There was even the M1 carbine. The M1 carbine fired a, somewhat less, kind of a pistol caliber, low end intermediate cartridge. You could even argue the 7.62 by 25 Tokarev. A powerful cartridge for its size, the same thing. So there was nothing really new there. Faster follow-up shots were just a happy coincidence. The lever action was never designed to have suppressive fire or to be something that you could take on 20 people with. In fact, the U.S. Army, the reason they went with the trapdoor system and kind of stayed with a full power cartridge, well, for a long, long, long time, was that rifle engagements were going to be at 100 yards or over, and in which case pistol caliber carbines perform rather poorly. Not everything was seen to be close combat, and I thought if it is close combat, well, then we have these very powerful rifles that can do that also. And as machine guns came in, and certainly later submachine guns, there was, you know, you wanted a kind of overlapping capability. Yes, you can use your M1 at 10 yards, 15 yards, but you also have Thompsons, carbines, grease guns that can handle that, even 1911 pistols up close. And all those guns have a range limitation that the M1 rifle then would exceed. So the M1 rifle kind of fit in with the series of small arms that were there. Lever-action rifles, you can make an argument that, yes, maybe they should have had three or four guys armed with one and a couple guys armed with the Springfield trapdoors. You can make that argument, but I don't think it was ever happened. The lever-action was also inherently a bit frail. You dent the tube, and it doesn't reload so well anymore. You know, firing hundreds of rounds through it at a single sit-in was probably not, even the more modern ones like the 94 and 92, probably not in the cards. You know, they do have some durability issues. There's a lot of parts moving in concert there. So it was never really that way, and the Army was wise not to adopt that. The same way the British Army did not adopt anything like that. The same way no other army adopted anything like that. And the only time this ever comes up is during the kind of absurd theoretical, well, if the British Army had had Winchesters, Ishluwanda would have wound up different. Or the 7th Cavalry had had them, maybe Little Bighorn would have been different. Well, the fact of the matter is the arms they had were sufficient for what they were doing. There's just no real proof that anybody would have ever thought these things were actually assault rifles. They knew that they were reasonably fast handling from the standing or sitting or kneeling position. They don't work so well in prone, but, you know, from a variety of positions, they're reasonably well handling, reasonably powerful, reasonably decent. You know, so, you know, they're okay, but they were never anything that made the large caliber rifle obsolete. And in fact, the only thing that made the large caliber rifle obsolete were other large caliber rifles that had a magazine feeding system. Nobody basically said, we're going to junk our trapdoors and go to the Winchester Model 92. You know, they just wouldn't do that. So there you go. It's not the first assault rifle, and it is not true that is the first assault rifle. It's a weapon that had its own unique set of capabilities and uses. And for somebody alone out on the frontier, it's a good, because for short range, you can definitely get quick follow-up shots. But for all around general military use where you have numbers of troops, it was not the answer. Okay, last question. Which rifle would you rather have in World War II? A 1903 A3 or an M1917. Okay, the 03 A3 was basically the World War II kind of production of the Springfield rifle with an aperture sight that was on the rear of the receiver bridge. So it was a very nice thing. Very nice rifle, and they shot very well, even with the two groove barrels that later people swore were not as good. They've done accuracy tests, and the difference between a two groove, a four groove, and a six groove doesn't matter. The M1917 was, of course, the rifle used in World War I when not enough Springfields could be produced. And frankly, I like the 1917 better, simply because the sights on it are more durable. The 03 A3 has got that same kind of Springfield exposed front sight, so if you bang it on something, you'll definitely bend it or get it out of the way. Whereas the 1917 has got those nice big protective ears that protect the front sight. And I like the aperture setup on the 1917. It just makes a lot of sense. Good rifle. So that would be the bolt action rifle I'd go with. Either one is fine. The Springfield is certainly lighter, and the Springfield certainly is a very accurate rifle. So they're both very nice. I like the 1917 a little bit better. That's just my personal preference. I'm sure that there are people that prefer the 0383. And the 0383 does have a finer blade, so if you're doing more precise shooting at long range, that could be helpful also. So that would be the answer I would have. 1917, one, and 0383, number two. I will also say, though, if you had a bolt-action rifle on a World War II battlefield, you're really going to be, it isn't a choice between which one of those two is better. It's how can I get an M1, a rifle, a carbine, a Thompson, or a Sturmgewehr, or something else. How can I get something with more high firepower? Because really, the bolt-action rifle was pretty much not the weapon to have on the World War II battlefield. It just wasn't. There were a lot of other options that were probably a whole lot better. So anyway, that concludes this episode of Old School Guns. And you know, like us on Podbean or whatever platform you're listening on, go ahead and hit the like, hit the follow button. And always, you can always send me questions in the comments section or hit kbmakel@aol.com. That's kbmakel@aol.com. And you can go ahead and send me something there. But for now, this is Old School Guns, out.